All right, welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're going deep on a Supreme Court case that, kind of sits right at the intersection of how our legal system approaches young people.
Yeah.
We're talking McKeever v. Pennsylvania, decided back in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And this one grappled with a question, a really fundamental one for anyone, really, who's interested in legal studies. And that is, when a young person, a juvenile, faces delinquency charges, do they have a constitutional right to a jury trial?
That's exactly it. And, to really get a grasp on McKeever, you have to kind of see it in the context of what came right before it,
yeah.
Especially that Inree Gault decision back in 67.
Right.
Gault, huge landmark ruling, really expanded due process rights for juveniles, gave them things like the right to an attorney, right to counsel,
right.
Confront witnesses.
Yeah.
And so a lot of folks who were watching the court thought McKeever might just be like, the natural next step, extending that right to a jury trial. But the court ended up charting a very different path. Really, really interesting distinction there.
Yeah. And to really see why they made that choice, why they drew that line.
Yeah.
We have to look at the actual cases. Yeah. The cases themselves that were bundled together and brought before the court.
Right.
And there were three total. Each one really kind of highlights how this legal question played out in the real world. So first you got Inree McKeever itself,
right.
Came out of Pennsylvania. Yeah. You had Joseph McKeever, 16 years old,
okay.
Facing some pretty serious charges, robbery, larceny, receiving stolen goods. He asks for a jury trial. This is my basic right, he argues, but the request is denied.
Wow.
And a judge ultimately finds him to be delinquent.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the second Pennsylvania case, Inree Terry.
Okay.
This time, Edward Terry, even younger, just 15 years old, when he's charged with assault and battery on a police officer and conspiracy. So, again, denied a jury trial, adjudicated delinquent. So both these Pennsylvania cases, they're directly challenging this idea that these serious juvenile charges, right, they can be decided without a jury.
Yeah, yeah. You're really hitting on something. This is like core to how we think about justice.
Right.
Is a jury necessary?
Exactly.
In these sorts of situations.
And then you have the third case, Inree Bruce. This one's out of North Carolina. Much larger group this time. Around 45 black children. Ages range from 11 to 15.
Wow.
Charged with impeding traffic during civil rights protests.
Oh.
What's really striking about this one is that they were not only denied jury trials,
uh-huh.
but their hearings, the hearings in juvenile court, actually closed to the public.
Oh, wow.
So it really underscores just how much potential there is for these proceedings to happen outside of public view.
Yeah. So you have these three different situations, right? But they all kind of converge on one key legal question that the Supreme Court had to answer. In each one of these, the young people involved, they were looking for that protection that a jury trial offers. They argued it was a critical safeguard, especially with those big potential consequences if they were found to be delinquent.
Right.
But the state courts, they weren't having it. They upheld those denials. And that's what set the stage for the Supreme Court to step in and make like a definitive ruling on this, this really crucial aspect of juvenile justice.
Okay, so we have these three different situations,
mm-hmm.
right, converging on this central legal question. And it really boils down to this. Does that 14th Amendment's due process clause, does that guarantee young people the right to a jury trial during that adjudicative phase of these state juvenile delinquency proceedings?
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of legalese, but it gets to the heart of what the justices were debating,
Exactly. And it really becomes like, was a jury trial, was that a necessary part of fundamental fairness, right? When a young person's liberty is potentially on the line. And after looking at these cases, examining all the arguments, the Supreme Court made its decision.
And what did they land on?
And they ultimately said no. They held that a jury trial is not a constitutional requirement. It's not required by the Constitution in these juvenile delinquency proceedings at the state level.
Now, you mentioned earlier that while they reached a single conclusion,
yeah.
the reasoning wasn't completely unanimous.
Right.
So let's dig into that. We have these different opinions written by the justices.
Yeah.
And those perspectives really offer some valuable insights into just how complicated this issue is and how the justices were, really thinking about it at the time.
Absolutely. So to start, let's kind of break down that majority opinion. Justice Blackmun delivered that one. And his main argument was basically this idea that, juveniles, yeah, they're entitled to due process, as was established in Inree Gault.
Right.
But that doesn't automatically mean they're entitled to every single right that adults have in a regular criminal trial.
Right. Okay.
So the standard they're setting for juvenile proceedings was this idea of fundamental fairness.
Okay.
It's a somewhat less strict concept than maybe what you'd see in an adult criminal trial.
So that idea of fundamental fairness, that seems to be, you know, the core of the majority's decision.
Yeah.
It's like they're saying, you know, yeah, young people, they have rights. Mm-hmm. But not necessarily the exact same rights as adults who are facing criminal charges.
Exactly.
So what was their reasoning for making that distinction? What was it about jury trials specifically that they felt like wasn't a part of this, you know, fundamental fairness for juveniles?
So one of the main concerns the majority had was about what introducing jury trials would do to the whole nature of the juvenile justice system. They were worried about, like, what they called adultifying the system, mm-hmm. making it more adversarial, more formal, and ultimately that would undermine its whole focus, which they saw as rehabilitation. The idea was, like, juvenile courts, these are supposed to be more therapeutic, less punitive than, say, your standard adult criminal court. And Blackmun actually puts this really key quote in the opinion. He says, "The juvenile system's promise remains. We shouldn't abandon it to formalities."
I mean, that quote really kind of sums up their whole mindset, right?
Yeah.
That this fear that the informality, the guidance-oriented approach to the juvenile system,
that
could be lost if they were forced to adopt all the procedures, the more rigid procedures of adult trials, like jury trials. It almost suggests they thought that judges who specialize in juvenile matters, they'd be better at serving the best interests of the child than a jury of, you know, everyday people.
Yeah.
But doesn't that also raise the question about whether there might be bias within that more informal system?
Yeah, that is a really crucial point. So you have the court emphasizing this paternalistic model where the judge is seen as acting in the best interests of the child, which on its face, you know, has some appeal. But it does make you wonder, does that model actually protect against bias? Or maybe even overreach by the system itself?
Yeah.
Could a jury, even with that potential for more formality, maybe offer a different kind of accountability, a different safeguard for that young person?
It's a tough line to walk, right?
Yeah.
Because you want to prioritize rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want to do that at the expense of the fundamental checks and balances within the system.
For sure.
So the majority seemed to be prioritizing this distinct juvenile system that was more flexible, more focused on rehab, over that very specific due process right of a jury trial.
Yeah.
But not all the justices agreed. We've talked about that. So let's get into those dissenting and concurring opinions, starting with Justice Douglas.
Okay, so Douglas, he took like a completely different view. His main argument was focused on what a juvenile stands to lose, you know?
Okay.
Potential loss of their liberty in these delinquency proceedings.
Right.
He basically said if the consequences, like potentially being locked up in a correctional facility, if that's basically the same as what an adult would face in criminal court, then why wouldn't those same due process protections apply, including that right to a jury trial? He just didn't see a good reason to lessen those protections just because the person involved is younger.
Yeah, and he had a really strong quote that hammered this home, didn't he?
Yeah.
Something that really challenges that whole idea of treating juveniles differently when their freedom's at stake.
He did. He said the 14th Amendment protects any person, and then, like, really emphasized this. He was like, not just adults.
Wow.
So he's essentially saying, like, the Constitution, it doesn't, like, create tiers of protection based on how old you are.
Right.
Especially when we're talking about rights as fundamental as the potential of losing your freedom. Makes you think about whether the court's focus on age is really justified when the result could be a loss of liberty.
Yeah, I mean, that's a compelling point. It really challenges this notion that just because the juvenile system aims to rehabilitate, that it justifies, you know, like a weaker standard of due process, even though the outcome could still be confinement.
Mm-hmm.
So what about the concurring opinions? What other perspectives, other nuances did they add to this whole debate?
Okay, so Justice White, in his concurrence, he agreed with the majority's, like, final decision.
Mm-hmm.
But he really zeroed in on the goals, right?
Uh-huh.
The different objectives of the adult system versus the juvenile system.
Okay.
He was, like, really hammering on the fact that the primary goal for juveniles is rehabilitation.
Okay.
Not punishment, which is kind of the main focus of the adult system.
Right.
And he argued that because of that difference in goals, the risks, the specific risks that make juries so important in adult trials.
Like what?
Like, say, overzealous prosecutors or biased judges who are just focused on punishment. He said those risks are less of a concern in juvenile courts because the focus is different. It's on rehabilitation.
Mm. Okay, so that's interesting. It's saying that the nature of the juvenile system itself might actually provide a different type of safeguard.
Right.
So maybe there's less need for a jury as an external check.
Yeah.
But if the result of being adjudicated delinquent, if that can be just as severe as an adult criminal conviction in terms of losing your freedom and future opportunities, does the intent of the system really matter?
Right.
I mean, does it outweigh the need for those same fundamental protections?
Yeah, that's exactly the tension at the heart of it, right?
Right.
And then you have Justice Brennan, who gave a more nuanced opinion, concurring in part and dissenting in part.
Okay.
He made a distinction between those Pennsylvania cases where it seems the hearings were open to the public versus the North Carolina case where those hearings were closed.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically said that having public access in Pennsylvania, that acted as a kind of check on the proceedings, kind of similar to how a jury is supposed to ensure fairness.
Right.
But those closed hearings in North Carolina, that he thought was a huge problem, really raised concerns about potential abuse, you know,
mm-hmm.
decision-making behind closed doors when fundamental rights are at stake.
So for him, it was really about the public being able to see what was going on.
Yeah, the presence or lack of it of public scrutiny was a big factor for him in deciding if there were enough safeguards in place, even without a jury.
And, you know, it really speaks to the importance of transparency in any judicial process, no matter how old the person is.
Absolutely.
Okay, so finally, we have Justice Harlan's concurrence.
Right.
How did his perspective fit into this?
Harlan's concurrence was really in line with his overall legal philosophy.
Okay.
He was a big believer in federalism, you know, the role of the states.
Right.
And he basically doubled down on his stance. He'd said this before, actually, in his dissent in Duncan v. Louisiana, that jury trials aren't actually required by the Constitution for states at all.
Okay.
Not in criminal cases, non-juvenile proceedings. His view is basically that the Constitution leaves that choice, whether to have jury trials, up to the individual states.
So we have this really wide range of opinions, all wrestling with this idea of whether young people facing delinquency charges should have that right to a jury trial. So when we look back at McIver's impact, what would you say its main significance is, and what are some of the implications that followed?
McIver is a turning point in how our juvenile justice law developed. It marked a hard stop in this trend of expanding due process rights for juveniles.
Okay.
Which had really picked up steam with Galt, right?
Right.
And so McIver, it really cemented the idea that those due process rights for juveniles, they wouldn't necessarily mirror the ones given to adults.
So this decision kind of preserved those core differences between the two systems, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Especially that focus on rehabilitation, which a lot of folks who support the juvenile system, they really point to that, right?
Yeah.
So has that been the legal landscape since then? Are jury trials still not a constitutional requirement in juvenile courts around the country?
For the most part, yes. The Supreme Court didn't completely ban states from letting juveniles have jury trials.
Okay.
But they also didn't say it was a constitutional right. You know?
Right.
So because of that, most states still don't require jury trials in these types of proceedings. It's important to remember, though, things aren't totally uniform.
Okay.
There are over 10 states that do let juveniles choose to have a jury trial in some situations.
Oh, interesting.
Which means that the debate is still alive and well, you know?
Hmm.
And the approaches can differ a lot depending on the state.
So it really gets back to that central tension, is this idea of fundamental fairness. The way the court saw it in McIver, is that enough protection for young people?
Yeah.
Especially when they could lose their freedom and when those records, those delinquency records, can have a lasting impact on their lives.
Mm.
I mean, that's a question that legal experts, policymakers, and people who work in the juvenile justice system are still grappling with today.
For sure. And for those listening who are in law school, you know, wrapping your heads around the subtleties of McIver, super important.
Absolutely.
Just like a perfect example of how tricky it can be to take these big constitutional principles and apply them to specific situations.
Right.
It shows that constant balancing act. How do we make sure there's due process, but also recognize that these specialized legal systems, like the juvenile one, they have their own unique goals and traits.
So for our future legal eagles who are really getting into this area of law,
mm-hmm.
what are some key takeaways from McIver v. Pennsylvania they should keep in mind?
All right. So first off, it's crucial to get that difference between fundamental fairness in juvenile cases versus all those due process rights adults get in criminal trials.
Mm-hmm.
McCaver is like the poster child for where the court drew that line.
Okay.
Second, pay really close attention to how the justices explain their reasoning in those concurring and dissenting opinions. Like Justice Brennan, he was all about how important public access is as a safeguard.
Mm.
In Harlan, he came at it from a federalism perspective, you know,
right,
leaving the decision to the states. Those are crucial alternative viewpoints. They
yeah.
really add depth to how you understand the case.
Right.
And it's also so important to connect Justice Douglas's dissent back to this bigger discussion we're having about like the lasting consequences for young people who get caught up in this system
mm-hmm.
and the stigma that comes with it. I mean, those delinquency adjudications, they can seriously impact a person's future chances, just like a criminal record.
Yeah.
So thinking about whether they should get similar protections, that's a major takeaway.
That's a really good point about those practical consequences. Even though a delinquency finding isn't called a crime, you know, the same way as an adult conviction, it can really change the course of a young person's life.
Exactly. And when you're studying the case, try to pick out those specific factors and things the court seemed to really consider when making their decision.
Yeah.
Even if they didn't lay out like a formal step-by-step legal test, stuff like how might jury trials affect the efficiency of figuring out the facts in juvenile courts?
Right.
And that idea of keeping the system flexible, those were definitely on the majority's minds.
Right.
And it's really helpful to compare McCaver to those earlier landmark cases in juvenile justice. In Regault, the right to an attorney.
Oh, right.
And Rewinship, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Seeing how due process for juveniles has evolved through those cases will give you a much deeper understanding of this whole area.
So at the end of the day, McIver forces us to think about this really basic question about the juvenile justice system, right?
Yeah.
What's its philosophy? How should it operate?
Mm-hmm.
Should rehabilitation and informality ever be prioritized, even if it means potentially sacrificing those basic constitutional safeguards?
Right.
Like the right to a trial by jury.
Tough question, for sure. No easy answer.
Definitely a tough balancing act.
It is. And McCaver v. Pennsylvania, it stands as this really big lasting landmark in that struggle to find the right balance.
Mm-hmm.
It made it clear, at least under the federal constitution, there's no automatic right to a jury trial in these delinquency cases.
Right.
It highlights that tension between making sure young people get due process while also keeping those unique and sometimes debated aims of the juvenile system intact.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into McIver, I want to leave you with something to think about that kind of builds on what we talked about, but we didn't really dig into it in detail. We've seen some places take a more punishment-focused approach with juveniles,
yeah,
kind of like the adult system. And we also know that kids who get involved in the system, they can face some really serious long-term consequences.
For sure.
So think about this. If the Supreme Court were to decide McIver today,
mm-hmm.
knowing what we now know about how teenagers' brains develop, the impact of having a juvenile record, would their decision, or at least the logic behind it, be different?
It's a great question.
It's definitely something to chew on.
Mm.
Absolutely. And I really encourage everyone to look into how those procedures differ from state to state and to keep exploring this whole debate.
Yeah.
It's a lively one about finding the right balance between rights and rehabilitation and juvenile justice. There's so much to learn, so many different perspectives out there.
Absolutely.
Really fascinating stuff.
All right, that's going to do it for this deep dive.
See you next time.
Catch you later.